Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm great. I'm great. Just had a delicious organic pear from a little co-op that my wife and I belong to.
Great,
and it was delicious.
I had a crappy bagel from the 7-Eleven.
It wasn't from the 7-Eleven.
I'm a little jealous.
But, yeah, it was delicious.
So, speaking of delicious, you know, the old adage used to be you never eat oysters if you're not in order to eat oysters locally around here in the Northeast, you'd only do that in a month with an R in it. So,
that's
from
right.
September, October, November, December, January.
Keep going.
February,
right.
March,
yeah.
April.
Yeah.
Not May, June, and July.
No May, June, and July.
And no August.
Right.
And the reason was, the reason was that around here, the waters, when they get warm, that's when if there are, back in the day, that's
well,
when.
Still.
But back in the day, that's when it's an infection or bacteria is likely to spread through, a bloom, as they call it, is likely to spread through an oyster bed. Well, except that our oyster beds are now very closely monitored.
Very closely monitored.
And actually, you know, when we get oysters in the restaurant, I don't know if you know this, when we get oysters or any kind of a mollusk in the restaurant, pardon me.
It's tagged.
And so we get a mesh bag of oysters, and we need to conserve those tags for a certain number of days. So there's a hook in the kitchen where they go on so that if there's a problem with an oyster, they can track.
Or any mollusk. I mean, whether it's oysters or clams, any of that kind of stuff that we
buy. Where they can track where those oysters went to, and you can go back and look at your bag and see if you have any tainted oysters. Now, that being said, we've been in the restaurant business for 20 years.
No one's ever looked at that.
No one's ever asked us to, yeah. So
it's one of those things that you have to keep, and we've always kept.
And that comes from a history of oysters were very, very important in the Northeast for a long time. And they're very, very important ecologically because they clean the water.
Yeah, it's kind of. And Francis and I have done a couple of shows on oysters, but there's a great show, great article this week in the New York Times on some of the local oyster beds around here. And there's a co-op that is started this great new program. And actually, my aunt and uncle, who I vacation out in
Quag,
in East Quag, at my aunt and uncle's house, they have a house right on Shinnecock Bay, and a canal that lets right onto the bay. And they've been approached by the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Suffolk County, basically a division of Cornell that's responsible for, in this case, aquaculture.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they, and this is the same group that helped develop some of the vineyards out on Long Island that currently exist, and they've done a lot of really, really good work. But they've approached people who live on the water to say, hey, we'd like to grow some oysters here. And the idea is twofold. The idea is, one, we'll kind of bring the oyster population and some of the oyster and clam and mussel beds back to Long Island where they were. I mean, they were really abundant when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You basically walked out the door, you clammed, you mussled, you scalloped.
So what's the catch?
There's not really a catch. They basically bring you trays of baby
seeds.
And your job is to monitor them, okay? You pay a small fee, a couple hundred bucks, to get this program started. And you split the harvest with the co-op.
That's great.
And it's really interesting. So their water's already been tested in their canal. They've been approached to be part of this program.
So they're going
to
do it?
I think they are. And they've basically said that, you know, what will happen is their water has to be a certain cleanliness already, which Shinnecock Bay is pretty clean. And their particular canal is also pretty clean and kept pretty well. So you have to start with a certain amount of quality water in order to be able to eat the oysters. But once you do that, what's basically going to happen is their water is going to continue to get cleaner and cleaner and cleaner,
mm-hmm,
and cleaner,
mm-hmm,
where most of the water that where is in the world right now is getting dirtier and dirtier and dirtier and dirtier.
Well, they say, you know, introducing mollusks and of all sorts into waters does make it cleaner. And if you're in waters where it's clean enough to eat the oysters, there's a real boon there. It's a way to take something out of the harvest, something out of the out of the water that makes it that's actually more beneficial. And one of the things that's interesting in restaurants, you see, when you go out to restaurants more and more, especially in the Northeast, people talk about Shinnecock Bay oysters,
Cape May salts,
Prince Edward Island mussels, you know, PEI oysters. And what's happening is that much like people say a wine can taste of a certain vineyard, oysters can taste of a certain body of water. I mean, it only makes sense. All they do is filter that water through them and through them. So the microflora, the microfauna, the microorganisms, a lot of them very beneficial, that are in that particular part of the Long Island Sound will give an oyster a different flavor and taste than an oyster grown elsewhere. So there are species differences between oysters, but very few. Most of the differences you find in oysters is the temperature of the water affects the oyster. The microorganisms in the water affects the oyster.
How fast the water's moving.
Well, and also, you know, the Shinnecock Indian Reservation right off of Shinnecock, they have the Indian Reservation itself is getting into the oystering business again. But it's a lot of work, and they say that, you know, if you've ever seen commercial oystermen, you know, the idea is not that you just plant these seeds and you watch them grow like grass. You know, you've got to take care of the shell, make sure that the shell isn't very sharp around the end, make sure you get a deep cup in there, which leads to the production of more meat in the oyster. But what you're seeing more and more, and you see this on restaurant menus, is the name of the oyster. Now, the most abused one is Blue Point oysters. Blue Point actually refer to a specific place, a very old place in Long Island Sound where you can grow oysters. Unfortunately, that's a name that's used for oysters that, you know, I've had oysters from Virginia that say Blue Point oysters, you know, come into the restaurant. I'm like, well, that doesn't really make sense because Blue Point's not in Virginia.
Right.
But you're seeing more and more of these little bays come out, and it's a very good thing for the local food movement. If you talk to our friend Peter Hoffman at Savoy Restaurant in Manhattan, and now at Back 40 in Manhattan, he doesn't even serve West Coast oysters, not only because he doesn't like the taste of them, but he's like, why would I?
Right.
I
talk
live
about,
in New York City. Why would I serve an oyster
I
from
mean, you talk about
country?
Using local products. You know, local oysters are as local as you can get.
Wow. And so I think it's a – and more – you see those names on restaurant menus, and you see people really enthusiastic about when they're coming in. And the other thing I just want to end with is the old adage about we'll end where we began, the old adage about not being able to eat oysters unless the month has an R in it, that's really no longer the case. I mean, there's a spring oyster season that goes on right now in May. The oysters start to fatten up for a spawning they do in the fall. And the oyster and the baymen can manage the life cycle of the oysters, so we can really get good oysters all year round, especially if you're up here in the Northeast. There's just great stuff up here. But then also down in Louisiana and on the West Coast as well.
The oysters change in flavor a little bit during the season, but they're potable.
So we're going to take the show decidedly less local when we come back. We're going to have back on the show joining us again is cookbook author Patricia Wells about her new book, We've Always Had Paris and Provence, a scrapbook of our life in France. It's a wonderful memoir, and we'll be talking with her in just a moment, so just stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today joining us again is Patricia Wells, who's lived with her husband, Walter, for nearly 30 years in Provence. She runs a popular cooking school in Paris. She's the author of over 10 books. She was the restaurant critic for the International Herald Tribune for 27 years, and she joins us today to discuss her memoir.
How
Patricia,
are you?
Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Last time you were here, we were talking about vegetables.
That's right.
It was a very nice show, but I think talking about your life in France is going to be more interesting.
You didn't like vegetables? What's the matter? Hey.
No, I liked vegetables, but I absolutely love this book.
Yeah, I like vegetables because I have to eat them.
That's the wrong attitude.
See now, Mark's father is French, and I'm Irish, right? So he has sort of this understanding of French people, and he would always look at me knowingly whenever we'd be in France and something would happen, and I just wouldn't know why or the wherefore or the context of it. And I think I understand. It took me many years to learn the little that I do, but reading your book was wonderful.
Well, thank you.
I particularly like the chapter you spend on rules, about how the French have rules, but then they don't always obey them, which is the thing that always frustrated me about being in France.
Well, you know, when we first moved here, I thought, you know, I realized, you know, well, in America, we don't have a lot of rules. We're pretty, you know, laissez-faire, do what you want, you know. But in France, as soon as we moved here in 1980, I realized there was a rule for everything, you know, getting in and out of a taxi, what, you know, coming, being a guest at dinner table. I mean, everything had a rule. And I thought, well, this is going to be a piece of cake. All I have to do is figure out what the rule is and follow it, and I'll get along real well. Well, it's not that easy.
No, it's really, you know, I'll tell you, I did live in France for about 4 months myself, and I just never knew how many times I was supposed to kiss somebody.
Well, it depends on where you are, right?
Exactly. That was one of the hardest rules.
Just another.
Well, no, but the thing is, let's talk about the fact that there are all of these rules, but then if I talk to my French friends, like, well, that's the rule, then that's how you do it. I'm like, well, but you didn't do it that way last Thursday. Go, oh, that was Thursday.
It's Thursday. First Thursday of the month. We don't do that.
So let's talk about some of the things, you know, specifically about entertainment, hospitality. I love, you have a little section, a little list of rules you love here, and I'll just go down a couple of them. If you entertain on Friday, you must serve fish, no matter what your religion.
Right.
You may serve seconds of the first course and main course, but never soup, salad, cheese, or fruit.
Right.
And this is who gets served first in order: the women, the guest of honor, the hostess, the men in order of descending age, and the host, and then finally the children.
I mean, it hardly makes you want to entertain, does it?
I know, my goodness. It's like a state dinner. But
well, one of our funniest stories is in one of my significant birthdays many years ago, we had both Chef Joël Robuchon and the mayor of the village. And we kind of didn't know who was more important, and we ended up putting Robuchon to my right. And we learned later that the mayor should have had, you know, greater importance, but he's not the mayor anymore, so that's what it is.
You know,
Joel Robuchon, come on.
Perhaps because of your dinner, everyone thought he was emasculated and didn't vote for him after that.
No, I don't think so.
Mark and I were in Italy on a wine buying trip many years ago, and we were sort of learning a little about that culture, because Mark's half French and half Italian, so I just follow him around. In Ireland, he follows me around.
Good.
I was sitting with some folks, and we were having espressos in their back garden, a winemaker, a friend of mine who I was buying wine from. And it was always endless glasses of wine and endless conversation. And then endless espressos. The coffee just kept coming out. And then he came out with a bottle of grappa, and he poured the grappa in our espresso cups. And
right.
We sort of swirled it around and picked up the last little dregs of the beans and drank the espresso and drank the grappa. And then everyone promptly stood up, because that, of course, is the signal for get out of my house.
Goodbye, right.
The
right.
French have a trick that you talk about as well.
Well, my favorite. We call it the orange juice trick. In the beginning, we used to go to a lot of fairly formal dinner parties, and you'd have, you know, the formal dinner in the dining room, and then after dinner, everyone would move to the living room, where the men would go to one side and smoke their cigars and the women on the other side, and you'd have your coffee. And then kind of just on cue, the hostess would come out with this big, it was usually a Cristofless silver and glass, big container of orange juice. And everyone would have orange juice, and then everyone would get up and leave. And we thought, well, this is kind of cool, but what does this have to, you know? It was great. It, you know, it sure beats going around and turning off the lights, which is one of my friends do. Or, as my husband likes to say, you know, just say, who needs a taxi?
Or you could just, I just sort of obviously yawn. But I'm usually the last one up, so I never, you know, people leave.
But, you know, those things work. They work, and they're interesting cultural rules.
Well, and you originally went to France at a time when maybe there weren't as many guidebooks or etiquette books or at least current information as there is now. Do you find that those rules sort of hold more still in Europe, those rules of etiquette, or are they sort of fading a little in the current
kind of the way they are here?
Fading. You know, the culture's gotten much, much more casual. Mm-hmm. One of our favorite stories, though, too, is about the French not knowing the rules or the etiquette. We once invited some French people for brunch on Sunday, and at 7 o'clock at night, they still hadn't left because they didn't know the hours of a brunch.
Oh, I love that. What is a brunch?
We didn't have any orange juice.
I was going to say, I would have gone out to get some orange juice for sure.
Well, now, you know, this extends to a house you own there as well. But let's go to commercial. I want to come back, and I want to talk about where you live in France exactly, because you live in two different places. I think that's kind of interesting. We'll be back in just a moment with Patricia Wells. Her book is We've Always Had Paris and Provence. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa? You can get a foot massage.
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
On the practical side again, it's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website. Ask for the Restaurant Guys promo or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're talking with Patricia Wells about her book, her memoir of her life in Provence. Now, you have a house in Paris and a house in Provence as well, right?
Right.
Now, I thought one of the things I really enjoyed was talking about when Walter and you encounter, you know, you find that in Provence you have truffles on your property.
Right.
And there's not really a strict no trespassing, those are my truffles, get away from them rule as there would be if it were in Verona, New Jersey.
Basically, if I had a truffles growing in my backyard, I would also be manning my backyard with a shotgun most days.
Well, you know, when we first moved there, we had no idea that there were truffles on the property. But there was a gentleman who was a neighbor who had seven dogs, and he had actually grown up in the house. And his father, unfortunately, sold the house because he wasn't doing too well. And so this gentleman kind of felt at home there, as one would believe. And he used to come up, and he would hunt truffles and give us a few and so on and so forth. But it was sort of as though everyone in the village who knew the property and knew the truffles would come up when we were there, when we weren't there. And, you know, pretty soon there were like little truffle wars where someone would say, hey, he's stealing your truffles. You know,
right. He's stealing your truffles. I wanted to steal them.
Exactly. So then at one point years ago, we were interviewing someone to do some gardening for us, and we decided it wasn't going to work out. But then he said, and during the conversation, he said, but I know I can get truffles for you. And so then when we decided it wasn't going to work out for him to be gardener, he said, well, can I still be your truffle man? And we thought, hey, this is good. If we give one person permission, then, you know, then
and he'll fight with the neighbor.
Right.
The truffles, right? Well, of course, it really didn't work out because, we, you know, we'd come up and of course, 5 minutes after we were on the land, he'd come up and hunt truffles and he'd hand us a few, and we never knew what we were getting, and it's just, but it's humorous. It was always very humorous.
You know, do you have enough truffles?
Well, actually, you know what? There are varieties of truffles. I know you were just talking about different oysters and so on and so forth, and there are different varieties of truffles, and ours are not the top variety. So I don't feel too bad when we don't get them because I have a good truffle supplier in town.
Can I tell you that you know, being in the restaurant business, we deal with a lot of French purveyors. Mark's father has an import-export business with France that deals with things other than food as well. And that is so dealing with like, the French business ethos. Is I'm not exactly sure what I'm getting, but he's not exactly sure what I'm giving. it's a very different way of doing business. I enjoy it in small batches. Well, when we come back, I want to talk about your experiences because you remain an important restaurant critic and food authority in a country where food is so important. I think that gives you a unique perspective, and I want to talk about that more after the news. Will you stick with us?
Okay.
Thanks, Patricia.
We'll be back with Patricia Wells about her book that she's written with her husband after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, we're speaking with Patricia Wells. Her wonderful new book, We've Always Had Paris and Provence, is a memoir. Patricia, you wrote about food in English in France and write about food in English in France. That's kind of an odd place.
Well, especially since the French don't usually read English.
Right. So your work is translated.
Well, they do pretty much now. Well, you know, what's interesting is, you know, from the book that we moved to France thinking we would stay for 2 years, and it's been 30 now. So, but when I came to France, it was really to write for Americans. I didn't expect to be writing for the French, and pretty soon they were reading me and listening to me, and I spent several years as a critic for L'Express, the French news weekly, and my books, majority of them have been translated into French, so they kind of have taken me under their wing and accepted me as one of their own, even though I still am the lady from Hamburgerland.
Well, now,
except hamburgers are more popular there now than they used to be.
Oh, well, more than they used to be, that's for sure.
But you're quite an authority on
well,
food.
Well, because I'm so old.
Well, no, but would you, in your chapter on the small inn you visited near Avignon, you had me sort of rolling.
Oh, that was a great. That was maybe my favorite chapter in the book.
One of the most miracle meals I've ever had in my life.
Will you tell us about that?
Well, a local winemaker, had told us about this restaurant outside of Avignon, and so we decided to try it out. And I called the night before to reserve, and I never reserve under my own name, but I don't know what happened. I said Wells when I called to reserve, and he said, "Not Patricia Wells." And I said, "Well, yes." And he said, "Oh, great, I love you, blah, blah, blah." So we got there. We drove there, getting lost, of course, and it was a dark and stormy night, truly, in November and very cold. We got there. And the restaurant had a sign that said they were closed for deep bereavement. And we thought, well, first of all, we felt really bad for the restaurateur, and then we felt worse for ourselves because we didn't know where we were going to eat that night. Turned out the guy had closed the restaurant just to cook for us. And it was the eeriest thing I've ever done. I mean, we were literally locked in the restaurant. He was president of the Petula Clark fan club and had Petula Clark playing the whole time.
He's a French musician.
I'm sorry?
He's a musician. We're talking music here.
Yes, and it just was a hysterically weird evening, and we were with another couple who were friends, but he kept trying to cook for us, and it was pretty awful.
Well, the guy didn't leave you alone, right? He came and he sat at your table and
talking in our face, and the ultimate was at the very end. He brought out his pet duck or goose, I can't remember which. I think it was a goose, who pooped on the floor. And
how did he react to that?
Pardon?
And how did he react to the duck?
He just said, "Mais c'est normal, ça."
It's normal.
That's nothing to worry about.
Please.
Please.
So
ignore the poop on the floor.
It was worth a meal, you know.
So you never went back to that restaurant again?
No.
And never drank the wine again of the person who recommended it?
And never spoke to them again either.
I don't see that friend anymore.
What's it like being a restaurant critic in Paris? One of the things I thought that was interesting that in your recounting of that tale in the book, you said that one of the things the chefs had said to you was, you know, so many of the restaurant critics are corrupt and you're genuine. Now, that rang a little true, though, right?
I mean, the interesting thing is we do at least, in that time, I think it's still true, that we do have a different standard of journalism in the United States. And I also at the time had a little more time on my hands, and so I would go to a restaurant usually three times before I'd even let them know who I was. I'd go with my husband one night, I'd go with some friend, female friends at lunchtime, go with several couples on a weekend to try to see, you know, different service and what it was like. And then I would introduce myself, talk to the chef, and usually try to spend a day or two in the kitchen with him or go to the market, or her, usually it was him. And for me, it was great because I got, not only did I get plenty of information and copy for my articles, but I got recipes out of it, and it was a great way to work. But they had never seen a French critics, you know, just come in with their feedback on, and usually didn't pay at that time. More of them do now, but, you know, they wanted to just be treated like royalty. And
so the critic would come in and say, "I am the critic here to review you, and I do not expect to pay.
And I will have a pedicure while I am waiting."
That's sort of like saying, son, I've heard that you have drugs in your room, and I'm going to go up there next Tuesday and look, and I'd better not find any.
I really enjoyed your perspective, and I read this in your book as well, that a lot of restaurant critics kind of almost enjoy when they have a bad meal because they know they're going to be able to write a great
a compelling review,
not a great review, clearly. But that you kind of get frustrated with yourself when you pick a restaurant that's not great for whatever reason.
I hated it. I mean, my goal was to always have a good meal. I mean, who wants a bad meal, you know? And you know, not a whole lot you can say about a really bad. I mean, you can, but what good are you doing? I mean, unless it's really like the incident of my the restaurant in Avignon, that's something different.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, they say that bad reviews sell, and that, you know, sort of cranky restaurant critics, like Alan Richman was just on the show, and he has a reputation for being a cranky restaurant critic. But every time he writes a cranky review, people read it and they say, "Did you see what Alan Richman said?"
Yeah, I think you can, you know, you can kind of get your reputation at what, you know, what it is you're looking at. But I don't know. I feel my job was always to tell you whether to go or not to go and what to eat when you go and how much it's going to cost.
Mm-hmm. I think that I would find it, especially because you do at the end of your anonymous visits and let them know who you are, pardon me, and maybe spend some time in the kitchen with the chef, I would think that after that it would be very difficult to write negatively.
Oh, I could do it.
Well, you're mean.
I mean, they weren't always, it's usually pretty upfront, and I would say, you know, I wouldn't just, you know, slam them out as a surprise. I mean, I would say, for instance, well, we had a wonderful time, except, you know, I didn't think that the turbo was particularly fresh or something like that. And they usually took it pretty well.
It must be, if you're spending time in the kitchen with a chef and you're a reviewer, that's kind of an odd, for me, that's an odd thing to think about.
And it's, Patricia, let me tell you, as the restaurant owner, on the outside, I take it pretty well. on the inside, it cuts me like a knife.
But it must be an odd thing to be in a chef's kitchen and say, you know, if you find them doing something that you don't like, to, you know, they have that look like, oh, no, you're not doing that.
Well, but the thing is, I wouldn't do that if I thought the restaurant was a real, you know, was horrible.
It was a dog.
Mm-hmm. I only did it if I already decided that it was a pretty good restaurant worth writing about and sending people to.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do that if it was a really horrible restaurant.
Now, you had a particularly close relationship, and that turns up again in your book several times, with Joel Robuchon, who's a historic chef.
I was very lucky to kind of grow up, you know, with him in a sense, because when his first restaurant was opened, this was about 84, 85, and I was just starting doing my first books. And we became kind of partners in a love of food and a love of the table. And I learned a tremendous amount from him, spending time in the kitchen with him. And I think the book Simply French, which is still done both in France and here and the United States. So it was a chance for both of us to learn a lot.
Well, and now you've written about it, so it's a chance for the rest of us to learn a lot. when we come back, I want to talk about having a place both in Paris and in Provence, and how that is kind of a unique way to live in France, and I think a pretty fortunate way to live in France. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Patricia Wells about her memoir, We've Always Had Paris and Provence. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1144.
The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking and at the same time rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the seven most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey everyone, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Patricia Wells about the book she co-authored with her husband Walter Wells, a memoir of their life in Provence. You can pick it up, by the way, at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Now, Patricia, you have a house in Provence. Your home there is called Chantaduc.
That's right.
And when did that happen, and how did that change your relationship with France, moving out and having a country home with a garden and all that stuff?
Well, we were actually invited to this house in 1981 by friends who had rented it previously in New York, and we came down and thought it was nice, and the next year we tried to rent it again, and the woman who owned it said it's not for rent, it's for sale, and one thing led to another, and we sold our apartment in New York and bought the house. And it, from the beginning, it changed our lives, because at that time, I was working on the Food Lover's Guide to France, traveling around, learning to understand French agriculture and all of the positive and negative aspects of growing grapes and raising corn, whatever it would be. And so it brought me much closer to the earth and the soil, and also to village life, with, again, its positive and negative qualities.
How difficult was it for you to acclimate to the culture of the village life, or to be accepted by the villagers? Are you yet accepted by the
villagers? Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think in every way, you know, the French respect you if you love food. And since I was writing about food, and they also respect anyone who's ever published a book. It's just incredible. So I gained their respect by both my love of food and being an author. And they also knew that, you know, we were enthusiastic, and we brought them plenty of business too. No, but basically all of our best friends are many of the merchants, the cheese merchant and the butcher and the baker and so on, man who sells our local truffles and so on. And they're kind of our family. And
well, I have to say, one of the places that I think the French have really gotten a little bit of a bad rap is if you try and integrate yourself into the French culture, if you try and ingratiate yourself, without exception, I was very well received by the French people.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I mean, in some ways we're kind of a curiosity, and so people want to know us and know about us a little bit, because especially in a small village, there's so many people who, like, they never leave the village all year long. You know, they don't travel a lot, and so they don't have a lot of, I mean, they have a great life, but not a lot of really totally different foreign experiences. And so I think we bring, you know, an exotic air to it. But also, as I said earlier, the enthusiasm we have for the region and the food gives us a mutual bond.
May I read a paragraph from your book?
Sure.
This is sort of the end of the paragraph about where you talk about your summer home. And you say, season after season, we work hard to make our mark on Chantaduc, a positive mark that will uphold its integrity. We also have to make sure that it will work with our modern life. But why would anyone look for an electric or gas oven when our mason can build us a wood-fired oven built of stone and heated by the year's vine clippings? Why would one install a stainless steel sink when our local supplier of old recuperated materials offers us models fashioned of sandstone or marble? You know, a lot of people look upon using those sorts of materials as very difficult and arcane and almost precious. It strikes me that your view of it is much more organic, and that's really the simpler way to go about it.
Well, Well, it's not necessarily simpler, but it is more organic. I mean, we use our bread oven all the time. And, you know, it's like anything that seems complex or difficult. Once you get used to it, you know, you light a match, you get it all ready, and that's it. And you learn how to cook in it, and food tastes better. And
the food tastes better is the answer.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, goodness gracious.
Well, and it also provides you with a connection, with a greater connection to where you are.
Patricia, yep. In our restaurants, we use a wood-burning grill with some local apple wood from local apple orchards here.
Oh, can I come for dinner?
Absolutely. And people look at us like we're nuts. So like, there's no gas line attached to your grill, sir. What are you doing?
Young line cooks who come to work for us, and we have to teach them one of the things you need to learn, because a grill is different than an oven, because a grill you need to maintain the fire a little more carefully.
Absolutely.
To maintain an even heat, whereas the oven sort of takes care of evening out the heat.
Right.
But maintaining a fire without even gas assistance, people, like young line cooks, look at us like,
Those are logs.
My daughter.
Right.
But, you know, it's also free flavor, you know?
It is. And you can't replace it. And it's just, you know, well, I love fires anyway. I love fireplaces. I love to see a fire burning. But there's also the idea that, you know, we're using either, you know, vine clippings from the vineyard. We're using oak that's been cut down from trees that have been downed. And it really is a sense of being very close to the earth, which, you know, there's nothing else that can replace that.
Well, and I do want to point out that in the book, many of your cookbooks, one of the things that's wonderful about them is they contextualize the recipes that are contained within them, and there's a bit of them that reads like a story. Here's a story that's peppered with recipes and very good ones taken from the stories. How did you decide what recipes to include in this very personal memoir?
Well, it was interesting because when we sat down to do the book, my husband and I worked out who would write what chapter and so on and so forth, and then we did most of the writing. And I kind of tried to find a recipe that would accentuate something about that chapter. For instance, in the early years of Nouvelle Cuisine, I remember that it was a day that, you know, raw foie gras or, you know, quickly seared foie gras was like really kind of risque, or, you know, it wasn't even called a duck carpaccio, but it was a duck breast that was sliced very thin and served raw, which was a very rare kind of thing to do in the early 80s. And so I included some of the recipes that, you know, I had written about in my restaurant reviews. And it was fun. It was fun going back and making some of these dishes. And then others just have to do with, you know, things that we love to cook at home for one another, a chicken with tomato sauce and feta cheese, and Walter's seduction dinner polenta, which he made for our first dinner he invited me to.
The seduction dinner polenta?
Yes.
I love that. Now, there was one recipe that really caught my eye among the many that looks absolutely wonderful. At the end of that very humorous chapter about the small inn in Avignon, you talk about the peach wine that you were served.
Right. It's peaches and white wine and cooked down and filtered, and it's a very delicious kind of aperitif for the summertime.
Well, we're a little bit away from peach season in New Jersey, but would you mind if we put this recipe up on our website so when it gets here, people can do something cool with
I'd
peaches?
I'd be delighted.
So my family always made peaches and wine when I was young, mostly red wine and peaches, but occasionally white wine.
This is done with white wine, but you could use red wine, or rosé would be good too.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll put the recipe up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, along with the podcast of this show. You can check it out anytime you like. Patricia, thank you for coming to join
us again.
Great,
Patricia. Thanks very much.
Thanks. It was great to talk to you again.
Patricia Wells' book is We've Always Had Paris and Provence, A Scrapbook of Our Life in France. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, it's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, back with you.
Earlier in the show, we were talking to Patricia Wells about some of the rites and rituals, not rites and rituals, but certainly rituals of dinner service in France, and I will never forget. As Francis knows, I have an aunt who still lives in Paris to this day. She was born in Paris, lived in the United States here for about 20 or 30 years, moved back to Paris. Mm-hmm. And she still lives there, and she is very, very rigid.
Yes, I'm aware.
Okay, very rigid.
I was not invited to dinner.
As a matter of fact, one time when Francis and I were in France together, you were copiously not invited because
Mark comes
she didn't
back
want
to the,
me to bring any of my crazy friends.
Mark had the adjoining hotel room, and it was –
me and Mark and a friend of ours named Jorge, and we had, were in Paris for a few days, and we were all in the same hotel. And Mark came back and said, "I just got off the phone with my aunt, and she invited me over for dinner." I was like, "Oh, great! What time?" She's like, "Doesn't matter. You're not invited."
That's true.
What? She said, "Well, I want to see my aunt, and it's kind of rude, but she specifically said."
She specifically said,
don't
"Come alone." Come
and
alone.
And what I thought was anybody like that, I don't want to go to her.
Yeah, you're probably right. Anyway, so one day, I'm there with my brother. We're fairly young, and she's made chocolate mousse specifically for us. Okay.
Yeah.
And you were talking about, you know, the appropriate number of servings. And so my brother had a serving of chocolate mousse, and it was very, very good. And my aunt said, "Well, aren't you going to have another?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, sure, I'll have some more. That's great." And he had a little bit more. And then he reached for a third time to take a spoonful of chocolate mousse.
Yeah.
And she turned, "What are you doing?" I was going to have a little chocolate mousse. "You are not."
Really?
She didn't say "you are not," but she was like...
She was offended.
She was offended. She was clearly... He had broken one of those...
Your brother was 30
rituals.
At the time?
No, my brother was 10. Probably 18 or 16 at the
time. Yeah.
And, you know, he went back for dessert for that third time, and that was clearly something that was inappropriate. Even though she had almost forced him to go back a second time, he went back for one more little spoonful, and it was a dreadful spoonful.
I was with a friend in Ireland, and we were sitting at my cousin's table, and my cousin's it was the end of the night. They put out a bottle of whiskey, and my cousin was pouring us all whiskey after whiskey after whiskey, and my friend got empty, and I guess my cousin wasn't paying attention for a moment, and she went and grabbed and poured herself a glass of whiskey. And it was funny, but they were like, "Oh, well, look at that. There's a woman for you. She pours her own whiskey." She had obviously, you don't sit at someone else's table and grab
little
and pour
faux pas.
Your own whiskey.
Little
it
faux
was
pas.
A little faux pas.
By the way, at my house, grab the whiskey. Have a good time.
Yeah, me too.
If the whiskey's open, you should be drinking it.
I'm just a crass American. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this hour with the restaurant guys. I know we've certainly enjoyed the hour with you. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the restaurant guys. 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.